I thought maybe I would come out from behind the podium, as I don't have a fancy PowerPoint presentation, so I have to do something to keep you awake. And sometimes moving out with the audience a little bit helps. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening. I lived for 8 years in the Washington, D.C. area and visited this very beautiful church from time to time, and it's very nice to be back. Almost feels like coming home a little bit. You have a little warmer falls than we do in Michigan, I've discovered, and it's nice to be back with you. I've had a unique privilege of being able to, mid-career, go back to school and try to answer some of the questions that I came up with the first time around. My undergraduate degree was theology, and then I went on to law school. And I've always been interested in church and state, the heritage of our country. And I studied that closely at law school, and I soon came upon a conundrum, a puzzle, if you will, as to how it was that a country that was earlier founded by a largely Puritan ideology, where church and state were combined, and an Anglican ideology where it expressed much the same, and there were a few dissenters who differed. And as an Adventist, I was well aware of Roger Williams and his stand for religious freedom and founding of Rhode Island and the separation of church and state. But when I began studying it at law school, I realized that Roger Williams, well, first of all, he was very much in the minority during his day. He was a persecuted dissenter. He was exiled from Massachusetts Bay Colony and elsewhere and sent off to Rhode Island. And Rhode Island wasn't particularly influential. It was out there on the extreme edges of the colonies, much like perhaps we East Coasters view California, you know, where all the cranks and the far out things happen. And so what happened 150 years later? We jumped to Jefferson and Madison. So the story, as I understood it, was Roger Williams and then Jefferson and Madison and the separation of church and state. And it wasn't fully explained how during that period of time the view that separation was a good thing went from being a persecuted, very small minority to now dominating our political outlook. And it was too easily and quickly and simply told. And the story is complicated by something that law professor Carl Esbeck has pointed out. Many of us tend to focus on the First Amendment when we talk about this establishment, but the First Amendment didn't apply to the states until after the Civil War. So at the time the country was founded, disestablishment had nothing to do with the First Amendment. And the fact is that disestablishment took place over about a period of 50 years, and it happened state by state, from one state to another state. And what this means practically is that disestablishment wasn't an idea carried out by a few deistic Enlightenment thinkers in Philadelphia, but you have to explain it as a grassroots phenomenon throughout the country. And as Professor Esbeck points out, when you're dealing with the grassroots, you're dealing particularly with religious ideas and beliefs. Most people on the farms and the frontier weren't Enlightenment thinkers. They were religious thinkers. They had a copy of the Bible and Milton at hand. So how did this happen? It is as though the history of America is a train with most of it being Puritans and establishment thinkers, and there's a caboose at the back with Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson and a very small group, and it goes into a tunnel and disappears for 100 years and comes out the other side, and suddenly the train is, well, Roger Williams' heritage, it's the Puritans that lose out, and very quickly by 1819 and 1833 the last state establishments are gone. So how did this happen? Well, the conventional story says that religion was part of the explanation, but it goes like this. Most of the ideas about the separation of church and state had to do with the skeptical Enlightenment, people who trusted reason and distrusted theology. And therefore, you needed to make sure the government was run only on reason and not on theology, which was considered irrational. Now, religion plays a role in this story because religious groups, minority groups, were being persecuted. So if you're persecuted, you have a pragmatic reason not to want to have an established church. So you'll be in favor of the separation of church and state, and you'll ally with these Enlightenment thinkers. And then another religious reason is that you have the First Great Awakening, which increases the religious diversity of Americans, making a lot more religious groups, and it becomes impractical for any one group to establish itself. But once again, the focus is on pragmatic, practical reasons why religious people believe in this. And really, the substantive ideology driving it is Enlightenment thought. Now, there were some red flags that came up, though, that made me distrust this conventional story. And a couple of them, one of them had to do with the fact that disestablishment occurred in places where there wasn't a huge variety of religions, most notably the middle colonies, first founded by, well, Maryland by the Catholics, and the Quakers founding Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The second was that in places where these minorities began as minorities and strongly separationists, they continued to stay separationists long after they'd become very influential majority. And the most obvious example are the Baptists in Virginia. For many, many decades, even a century or more, despite being powerful and influential, they adhered to a separationist perspective. And if it was purely pragmatic, you would think it had been left behind. Now, those were just indicators, and I wanted to get at the root of the matter. So what I've done is I went back to this period of the early to mid-18th century, and I said, I'm going to look at some theological thinkers here who looked at the topic of the public square, of church and state, and made arguments about separation. Maybe not complete separation, they were still learning about this, but advocated certain levels of separation. And people who look at them tend to focus on their political arguments, but with my theological background, I'm going to look at their theological arguments. What theological, biblical justifications are they giving for what they're proposing? And if I can find among different groups and different churches that they're using similar theological arguments, then that will be at least some evidence that theology played a real role in this, and it wasn't just pragmatics. And of course, you would expect different views from people on different from different theological backgrounds. But I chose three that were pretty diverse, given the religious identity of the day. I chose a Quaker, and a Puritan, and a Baptist. And I didn't look at Roger Williams because he lived about 100 years earlier than this, and I wanted to look at the founding period in particular. And so what I've done is I've gone through these three thinkers, and I'm going to share with you some thoughts from all three of them. And to sort of give you a sense of where I'm going, what I found and what I'm going to lay out for you is that I found a common shared view of theology and a theological justification for separating church and state that revolved around a number of issues, questions relating to the individual's relationship to truth. How do you find spiritual truth? Where do you find it? And the individual's duty to find that truth for him or herself and apply it to his or her life. And the fact that when those two things are combined, the third thing that emerges is that it's inappropriate for civil government to use force to ensure that. And this constellation of spiritual ideas, I would propose, can be found under the heading of a doctrine that we recognize coming out of the Protestant Reformation, the priesthood of believers. Priesthood of believers. Now, sometimes we think about that in terms of not praying to a priest, but praying directly to God, and certainly that's part of it. But it also involves notions of Bible study, that we also don't receive theological truth from magistrates or priests or the Pope, but that each believer has a responsibility, his or herself, to study the Bible for themselves. And some have called this the priesthood of believers, the forgotten doctrine of the Reformation. But my thesis here is that while it may have been largely overlooked in Europe, that the priesthood of believers had, of all the Reformation doctrines, the greatest civil impact, if you will, the greatest impact on the ordering of our society. Let me begin with the first thinker. William Penn is the Quaker that I looked at. You know him from the founding of Pennsylvania. Until a few years ago, if you went to Pennsylvania, no building could be built any higher than the statue of William Penn that stood atop the State House in downtown Pennsylvania. Now that has since been changed, but there was a certain irony to that because in life, William Penn was a Quaker, and Quakers didn't believe in tipping one's hat to another individual to show him respect. This was respect was due only to God. So I'm pretty sure that William Penn didn't set down this rule. It was done after he was dead. In fact, William Penn, an interesting anecdote from his life, he went into a courtroom and the judge to be tried on certain charges of violating religious laws, and he refused to tip his hat to the judge, and so the judge immediately held him in contempt of court. And the rest of the story is that Penn had taken his hat off before he went into the courtroom because he didn't want to face this dilemma. But when he came in, the judge ordered that it be placed back on so that he could trap Penn because he knew that Penn wouldn't take it off. But in any event, Penn was no ordinary Quaker. He was the son of a very wealthy English admiral who had close ties and relationship to the king. Indeed, Penn became a Quaker when he was in Ireland overlooking his father's lands and land holdings. He was a religiously impressionable young man, had spent some time in France studying with the Huguenots, studied law at Oxford, very well educated, but was impressed by the piety and the devotion of the Quakers and became one. But due to his contacts, he very quickly became a spokesperson for the Quakers. His advocacy role became, probably for his father, alarmingly hands-on, and he was arrested very quickly on a number of occasions and spent time in jail. And it was during his time in jail that he wrote a document called The Great Case of Liberty of Conscience. And this is nearly 70 years before other great statements in American history. 1670 he wrote it. And it was written from jail. It's an English document, but it's written by a man who founded one colony, Pennsylvania, who was involved in the founding of New Jersey as well, and Delaware was split off from Pennsylvania. So you can attribute to Penn the founding of three of our central colonies that had a great impact on our founding. So this document is very much a document of American history. And if you read it, he's a lawyer and leaves no stone unturned. And I'm not going to talk about all his arguments, because there are far too many, but I will share one with you before I jump into the his biblical arguments, and that is he didn't begin with human rights, with my right to worship God. He began with God's right to our worship. It turns things on its heads a bit, doesn't it? Today we tend to talk about human rights and individual rights, and it begins with me, I, at the center. But Penn says, no, it's God's rights that are being protected. He is the creator of all, the maker of all, and we owe him our worship. And it is my duty and God's right that I am standing for. Ellen White says the same thing, that it's God's rights that we are protecting. But he moves quickly into biblical teachings, and he uses the Bible quite widely. Many texts, but I think they break down into three groups. Texts detailing limits on human knowledge, or how humans gain spiritual knowledge, is the first part. The second part is limits on human authority in spiritual matters. And the third, and I think it flows from the first two, is the use of force in spiritual matters. And it's sort of like a syllogism. The first one is, you get knowledge, spiritual knowledge, from God. And the second one is, therefore, other people can't tell you what spiritual truth is or is not. And then what flows from that, if they can't tell you or judge you what it is, they can't force you to do it. It's a 1-2-3 definition of why force shouldn't be used in religious matters. Being a Quaker, he starts not with the Bible, but there's a text he uses, Job 32:8. The inspiration of the Almighty gives understanding. The inspiration of the Almighty gives understanding. The Quakers believed in an internal light, didn't they? God speaks to the individual directly. If Protestants believed in a priesthood of believers, Quakers believe in a priesthood of believer on steroids, right? That it is intensely individualistic, beyond even what probably we would say. He goes on to suggest that if no man can believe before he understands, and no man can understand before he is inspired of God, that it is unreasonable and inhuman to punish someone for not believing something. He then cites verses to emphasize the limits of human knowledge and the need to rely on God for spiritual knowledge. Woe unto them that take counsel of me. And then the second set of texts follow from this. No earthly spiritual judge. If humans cannot know spiritual truth except from God through the Holy Spirit, then no human is in a position or has the authority to ultimately judge others in spiritual matters. Jesus said that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, but it shall not be so among you. And then he goes to his third point, which is, if only one with full spiritual knowledge has authority to judge, then they cannot judge and coerce others in spiritual matters. Or to put positively, each individual must seek spiritual knowledge directly from God, and no individual has ultimate spiritual authority over another. Thus, the Christian practice should be one of persuasion and not of force. Now, that's his biblical argument. I will emphasize he uses a wide range of historical and philosophical arguments. Those are important. They're not merely redundant. They're important because if this is purely a biblical argument, then by his own definition, you can't enforce it through government. You have to be able to rest it on grounds of natural philosophy that are accessible to all. And he does use examples from history, and those of you who heard the very good presentation earlier on natural law will understand perhaps why that's important. But I need to move on to my second figure, and that is Elisha Williams, a Puritan. Now, you may not have heard of Elisha Williams, but you probably have heard of Jonathan Edwards, great Puritan divine who led out in the First Great Awakening. Elisha Williams was his cousin, part of one of the families known as the River Gods, the Connecticut River Valley Establishment, the gentry. And he was no radical outsider. He was the rector of Yale University. He was well known for his orthodoxy in matters of Calvinism. But he did have slightly differing views with other Puritans on the issues of church and state. And this came to the fore, perhaps because of he was trained both legally and theologically, and maybe his legal training had caused him to see some of these issues. But when the First Great Awakening came along, he was sympathetic to what was called the New Lights, the itinerant preachers who would travel around and share the revival and the new enthusiasm for the gospel. Of course, this troubled the establishment, and they'd set down rules enforced by the legislature that you couldn't travel outside your district. Traveling preachers had to get special permission from the powers that be, and you had to stay at home otherwise. Well, Elisha Williams was opposed to this, and he was willing to stick his neck out, and he lost his political positions for a period of time based on a document he wrote called A Seasonable Plea for Liberty of Conscience. And he eventually rebounded and regained his positions, but he certainly took a risk and sacrificed for a period of time for his stand. Elisha Williams began, unlike a Quaker, Elisha Williams did begin with the Bible. And in the very introduction to his statement, he says this: Sacred Scriptures are alone the rule of faith and practice to a Christian, that every Christian has a right of judging for himself what he is to believe and practice, and thus it is inconsistent with any power in the civil magistrate to make any penal laws in matters of religion. So you essentially have a syllogism, the syllogism of the priesthood again, put right at the beginning of this paper. Every Christian has a right and duty to read the Scriptures, to judge for himself or herself how they should be applied, and thus the civil magistrates cannot make religious laws, because, as he goes on to explain, the Bible is not self-executing. If you make a law based on the Bible, you have to put it into legal form, which always requires interpretation of the Bible. Therefore, and he makes a great point with his Protestant allies, the Protestants have rejected the Pope because they reject the notion that there is a superior earthly biblical authority. At least that's one of the reasons. And Elisha Williams says, but if you accept that legislatures can pass religious laws, you immediately create 100 popes. Because each legislature now has the authoritative interpretation of the religious idea in whatever law they put into practice, whether it be Sunday laws or what can be preached or taught in church. No popes, therefore no civil legislation. He was also used natural law arguments and talks about John Locke. There's a statement here that's worth quoting from Elisha Williams' paper. He mentions Locke by name, and then he goes on to say, "The right of judging everyone for himself in matters of religion results from the nature of man, and is so inseparably connected therewith that a man can no more part with it than he can part with his power of thinking. A man may alienate some branches of his property and give up his rights in them to others, but he cannot transfer the rights of conscience unless he could destroy his rational and moral powers or substitute some other to be judged for him at the tribunal of God." So the biblical ideas of the priesthood of believers, he also puts in secular terms of conscience. But you can see that it tracks. It's not a unrelated argument. It is an argument that is influenced by, that is helped by, that is shaped by his understanding of the Bible. Now, the third and final individual is a Baptist, and perhaps Baptists are best known for their view of the priesthood of believers and of separation. Isaac Backus was a remarkable individual. He didn't have a college education. He was self-educated. He began as a Puritan, but during the First Great Awakening became convicted that it was only the conscious and reasonable choice of individuals that could create a community of believers, and therefore adults should be baptized, and infant baptism was out. And while there was religious toleration for a variety of groups, there weren't for Baptists. And so he found himself quickly in the position of needing to defend notions of religious liberty. It's interesting to note, did not believe in John Locke or in natural law. Maybe he had a certain, hadn't gone to university and didn't like dealing with these English philosophers. But there may have also been a very practical political reason, and that was the Baptists hadn't decided which side of the American Revolution they were going to fight on. They were playing both sides of the fence. And the rhetoric on the revolutionary side was very much John Locke and natural rights. And Backus didn't want to be seen as buying into that. So he was basing his on the Bible. But he used very similar reasoning, once again, that the other thinkers did. And he wrote an appeal to the public on religious liberty a few years later after Elisha Williams. And while he got there a slightly different way, as he didn't talk about natural rights and John Locke, he ends up largely at the same place in regards to spiritual epistemology, how we know spiritual truths, the individual direct to God through the Bible, religious authority, the civil power has none, and the use of force not to happen in religious matters. In closing, Backus makes explicit what has lain beneath the surface of his arguments. He states that the disability of civil government in spiritual matters rests on the truth that each one has an equal right to judge for himself, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every man has not only the right but the responsibility to judge for himself and to act according to the persuasion of his own mind. So, in conclusion, it's doubtful. I've often thought, is it possible that any of these three individuals ever met? It's doubtful. We know Penn didn't. Penn died before Backus was born. Isaac Backus and Elisha Williams lived in Massachusetts and overlapped, possibly could have met, but ran in very different social and religious circles, so probably didn't. But what's very interesting is where their minds have overlapped. Baptist, Quaker, Puritan. Two of them accepted natural rights in John Locke. One of them rejected him entirely. One of them put the Spirit and the inner light over the Bible. The others would put the Bible over the inner light. Lots of disagreements about lots of theological things. But on the basis, on their views of church and state, their meeting of the minds around this notion of the priesthood of believers, the right of private judgment, the ability of the individual to read and study the Scripture for himself, equaling an obligation not to use force, means, I think, that a very good argument can be made that there is a theological core that led to, that contributed to, not on its own, but in tandem with other things, the separation of church and state. Now, why is that important to us today? Well, I think it's important for us as both Christians and Adventists. Often people say, what defines an evangelical? You know, belief in the Bible, belief in the cross, belief in conversion, belief in missiology. And those are the four main ones that thinkers often use. But I think this idea of the priesthood of believers is as important as those others and needs to be understood and on the list. And it's something, as Adventists, we should be particularly concerned with, because I would propose that the priesthood of believers lays the foundation, is the roots of the sanctuary doctrine. Where do we get the idea of a priesthood of believers if not in part from the book of Hebrews and our heavenly high priest, Christ's priestly ministry on our behalf? And I believe, and this would be for another lecture, but I believe that inasmuch as the priesthood of believers had the greatest civil impact on the formations of our government and understanding of religious freedoms, that our sanctuary doctrine likewise could have a similar impact today if we understood the relationship between freedom and morality that we are given an insight into through our sanctuary doctrine, that our political divisions are confused over. The left wing wants freedom but thinks they have to give up morality to achieve it. The right wing wants morality and an ordered society but thinks they have to give up certain civil freedoms to achieve that. An insight into the priesthood of believers and the sanctuary doctrine, I think, can help answer these very difficult questions. And so I leave you with those thoughts tonight.